Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Thanks so much for being here with us. We're awful glad that you take the time because we love doing this. And this hour and next hour, open forum. It's the internet open forum. All of our questions have come from the internet. And Jimmy Akin is our guest. Jimmy, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, the author of A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist, and The Bible is a Catholic Book, and a whole bunch of other things, and also the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Hello, Jimmy Akin.
Hello, Cyril Kellett.
Not tomorrow, but Friday, a new episode of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World will drop. What will it be this week?
Well, last Friday, we took a look at modern reincarnation research. There are researchers who investigate cases where typically a child reports memories of a past life, and they look at these and they investigate and see, well, are these supposed memories accurate or not? And then the question is, how do you explain these cases? And so this Friday, we're going to be looking at theories that could explain what are called cases of the reincarnation type. And we're going to be looking at a whole range of theories, and I'm going to be proposing a new theory that I have not seen in the literature on this, but that I think explains the data very well and easier than other theories explain it. And this theory does not actually involve reincarnation.
Ah, all right. Looking forward to that. You know, I was wondering as you're talking, is, you know, they have that thing called Munchausen by proxy.
Oh, yeah.
Is there such a thing as if a child report, like, is there ever a parent who has, is a disturbed parent, in other words, who has, have we had any evidence of that?
You mean in a case of the reincarnation type?
Yeah, where the child claims reincarnation, but really it's the parent who's coaching the child or that kind
yes.
of thing.
Yes, this is one of the things that reincarnation researchers watch out for. There have also been cases, not just, so we should explain, since you used a fancy term, we should explain what Munchausen by proxy is. Munchausen syndrome, the name is based on the fictional character Baron von Munchausen, who was known for telling extravagant tales. And the syndrome that corresponds to this, Munchausen syndrome, is where a person seeks medical treatment and they seem to just be telling a tall tale. You know, maybe they're a hypochondriac or they want attention or something like that, but they are not really sick, but they're presenting to the doctor as if they're sick for some reason. And Munchausen by proxy is when someone, typically a parent, presents someone else, typically a child, for treatment and says, my child is sick and I need you to treat my child. And really the child is not sick, but the parent is making it out as if the child is sick, such as to get money from insurance or to get attention or things like that. And the problem is really with the parent, not the child. So analogously, what you're proposing is, could parents who, say, believe in reincarnation and want to believe that their child is someone very special, could a parent coach a child into reporting past life things, even though the child has no native inclination to do so? And the answer is yes. And reincarnation researchers are alert to that fact, and they look for it. They also look for fraud, because there are cases of fraud in reincarnation research. One of the things they try to do is get involved as early as possible. Once a child starts reporting apparent memories of a past life, so that they can investigate it before a prior person has even been identified. Because that's one of the things they try to do, is they say, okay, this child claimed he lived in a neighboring village and he had this wife and he had this kid, so let's go to the neighboring village and see if anyone lives there that recently died, that had this wife with this name and these children and so forth. And if parapsychologists, reincarnation researchers, are able to get involved that early, this is known as an early bird case, because they have been able to intervene before the current family has had any contact with the prior family, and therefore they can't have adjusted their claims based on what they discovered by meeting the prior family.
Oh, yeah,
and so early bird cases are regarded as stronger than cases where there's already been contact between the family of the current child and the prior person. So that's how they look at the data. They try to be very careful about it. But there's still the huge question of how do you explain it? Is something, I mean, if the child has knowledge that goes beyond random chance of what you could just guess, then there it would seem that there's something passing between the child and the prior person. But what is it? Is it a soul? In which case reincarnation would be true. Is it some kind of residue that's not a soul? Is it simply information that's passing between the child and the prior person, say psychically? What's going on here? And so that's what we're going to talk about this week.
All right. You can check out Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, mysterious.fm, or just type in Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. You'll get there. We got a whole bunch of questions from the internet. We'll start with Jason, who asks this. What do you make of the statement in 1 Maccabees, chapter 12, verse 21, and its accuracy? Could the Greek demonym, Danans, be for members of the tribe of Dan, so that some Greeks were once Jews?
Okay, so we got two questions here. The first one is, what's the factual accuracy of 1 Maccabees 12:21? And so we need to read that. 1 Maccabees 12 contains a discussion of some correspondence between the Jewish people and the Spartans, who you may know were great warriors. And at this time in Israel's history, about 150 years before the time of Jesus, the Jewish people were in need of military allies. And so they had an alliance with the Romans. They also had an alliance with the Spartans. And they carried on this diplomacy with their allies, in part by personal visits, but also by letters that they would send between them. And so in 1 Maccabees 12, we're at a particular phase in that correspondence, and it's harking back to a letter that the king of the Spartans, a guy named Arius, had sent to the Jewish high priest Onias about 150 years earlier. And 1 Maccabees 12, starting with verse 19, says, "This is a copy of the letter which they," meaning the Spartans, "sent to Onias. Arius, king of the Spartans, to Onias the high priest, greeting. It has been found in writing concerning the Spartans and the Jews that they are brethren and are part of the family of Abraham. And now that we have learned this, please write us concerning your welfare." So you got the king of the Spartans writing the Jewish high priest saying, "We discovered some writings that say we're related, that we're both descended from Abraham, and so tell us how it's going." Well, so it's certainly possible that King Arius discovered some writings that said this. That doesn't make it true. In fact, we have pretty good evidence that Jews and Spartans, who were Greeks, are not both descended from Abraham. But it's certainly possible that Arius could have discovered some writings that said that, and he was under the impression that they were related, and therefore he wrote on that basis. On the other hand, there is another possibility, which is Arius is simply, he's being diplomatic. He's buttering them up. You know, he's not really being serious that we're literally related. And this is a kind of friendship greeting. So he's speaking as if we're related. And we do similar things today. You know, I was I was in a truck stop the other day, and the guy behind the counter kept referring to me as brother.
Oh,
I'm not literally his brother. And so, you know, we have fictive or fictional family relations that we use as part of social discourse and being polite and things like that. Sometimes you'll hear people say, "Hey, cousin," even though they're not cousins, or "Hey, brother," even though they're not brothers. And so that's another possibility about what's going on here. And of the scholars that I've seen commenting on this passage, nobody takes this really literally. In fact, I've even looked at old Catholic commentaries from a couple hundred years ago, and they all point out, like, this is not serious. So it could be that it's historically accurate in the sense that this is what Arius sent to Onias.
Right.
And it could be historically accurate in the sense that Arius believed they were related based on documents he had read. But it's pretty universally agreed they're not really biologically part of the family of Abraham. The second question that Jason asked was about a group called the Danans. He used the word demonym, which is a demos is a people. It's where we get the word democracy. It's rule of the people. And so a demonym is a people name, the name of a people. So like American is one of your and my demonyms.
Mm-hmm.
Well, some Greek literature, the Greeks are referred to as Danans. And so Jason is asking, could that mean that they were members of the tribe of Dan, which was one of the 12 Jewish tribes? And so some Greeks were once Jews. So the idea presumably would be that, you know, after one of the exiles, like the exile of the northern kingdom to the Assyrian, when they were conquered by the Assyrians, some of the Danites migrated to, you know, the Greek peninsulas or Greek islands and became known as the Danans. And so they assimilated Greek culture, and some of the Greeks originally were Jews. Well, we don't have any indication that Danites migrated out of Israel to become Greeks. They did get exiled from their land, and we're told where they went. We're told where the 10 lost tribes of Israel went, and it wasn't to Greece. It was to parts of Iraq and Iran. So that's where you'd look if you want to find Danites. Also, there's another problem, which is that the demonym Danan is used as early in Greek literature as the Iliad, and which is the story of part of the story of the Trojan War. And the Iliad was written by classically attributed to Homer, was written in the 700s BC. And that is too early for any Danites to have migrated to Greece and established a demonym like Danan that would have been popular enough to use in a major work like the Iliad. So the chronology doesn't work out. So it would appear that the name for Greeks, Danan, or Danan, or Danai, however you want to bring it into English, is unrelated to the tribe of Dan.
Jason, what a great question to start us off with. Thank you very, very much. We'll take our first break. Be right back with more Internet Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Do you have a question but prefer to ask it privately? Catholic Questions can help. Go to CatholicQuestions.com to ask your question online, email us, drop us a letter, or give us a call. Longtime Catholic Answers Live apologist and author Jim Blackburn or another Catholic Questions apologist will be happy to assist you. Catholic Questions proudly supports Catholic Answers Live, so visit us at CatholicQuestions.com today. That's CatholicQuestions.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
One of the reasons we should go to Mass is because it is the food of the saints that we receive. And for the saints, they understood rightly that the time after Holy Communion, that those moments are the most precious moments of our lives.
The Holy Sacrifice of the Mass, live from the EWTN Chapel, every morning, 8 Eastern, on EWTN Radio and Television.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. It's an open forum, an internet open forum, and Jimmy Akin is here with us both hours today. And here's a question from Michael. Michael says, I understand a common answer on Catholic Answers is that the era of, quote, public revelation ended with the death of the Apostle John. Any further revelation is considered, quote, private and not binding to the faithful. My question is, why? Wouldn't the era of public revelation have ended with the ascension of Christ? If not, and original apostles could add to public revelation, then why not their disciples and the disciples of their disciples, etc.?
Okay, so first of all, you will hear this on Catholic Answers, but it's not just Catholic Answers. This is not just an opinion of apologists who happen to work at Catholic Answers. This is actually church teaching. And so you'll find this in a variety of church documents, including, for example, I've seen it in works, you know, as recently as those by Benedict XVI. So this is a standard view. You'll also find this in the Catechism. Now, I don't think in the Catechism mention the death of, I should say, you will hear some people say the death of the Apostle John. That's not church teaching. There is a common view that the Apostle John was the last of the apostles to die. And therefore, it would have been at his death. But there are problems with that. The first one is it's not certain that John the Apostle was the last apostle to die. In fact, there is a tradition that you'll find in the in some early church writings that he died early and was martyred, which is another thing that you often hear, that he was the only one who wasn't martyred. But that's not certain either. There is an early tradition that says he was, as well as an early tradition that says he wasn't. So we don't know how the Apostle John died or when. And we also don't know that he was we don't know that he was the last one to die. Then there are, you don't want to assume that the apostles are limited to the 12 apostles, because there were other apostles that were fully apostles that weren't part of the 12, like St. Paul and St. Barnabas, who is referred to in the New Testament as an apostle. And then there are other people who are kind of on the fringe of being apostles. There are some passages that make it sound like they might be apostles, but it's not certain. And this would include people like Paul's traveling companions, Silas and Timothy. Because at some points, Paul will say things like, we apostles, and he seems to be meaning me, Silas, and Timothy. Mm-hmm. And so there, you know, Timothy's younger than Paul, so he could have lived into the second century. So it's not really clear where the boundary with the apostolic age is. What church teaching has been is that Revelation ended with the death of the last apostle, or with the passing of the apostles, whoever that was. Now, in terms of the question, would the era of public revelation have ended with the ascension of Christ? Well, it could have if God had chosen that. But in John's gospel, Jesus predicts that there's more revelation coming after his time. He says, after I'm gone, the Holy Spirit is going to take stuff that he's heard from me and the Father, and he's going to give it to you. And so he predicts that there's going to be further revelation coming after his time that sounds like it's going to be authoritative. Mm-hmm. And so that would make it public revelation. So since the age of public revelation extended beyond the time of Jesus, and another good reason to say that it did is, well, then the New Testament wouldn't count as revelation, because none of the New Testament was written before the ascension of Christ. So if the New Testament is the inspired word of God that reveals his will to us, well, then the New Testament is part of public revelation. So could it then have continued into the post-apostolic age? And the answer is yes. Yes, it could have, if God chose. He could have continued to give further revelation that is just as authoritative as what he had given previously, but the church has discerned that he chose not to do that, that there was a closure that coincided with the end of the apostolic age, and consequently, even though God does continue to give private revelation today, it doesn't have the same authority as public revelation does, and it does not add new doctrines to the faith. And that's something you will find, for example, in the Catechism of the Catholic Church. It says that Christian faith cannot accept new revelations that would claim to surpass or correct or supplement the revelation that we have from Christ and the apostles.
Michael, thank you very, very much. What a great question. This next one comes from Patrick. It's an internet open forum today, and Patrick writes, I have several follow-up questions to Michael's question. In Lamentabili Sane, Pope Pius X condemned the following proposition. Number 21, revelation constituting the object of the Catholic faith was not complete with the apostles. Was there any magisterial precedence for this condemnation? Go ahead.
Yeah, let me do that part.
Okay.
So notice what it says, revelation constituting the object of Catholic faith. So this would be things all Catholics are expected to believe. It's not private revelation. He says that he's condemning or rejecting the proposition that wasn't complete with the apostles. And was there any magisterial precedent for this? Well, I haven't looked it up, but I'm sure there was. Certainly, it was the common theological opinion going all the way back to the second century that this was the case, and I'm pretty sure that this got elevated from theological opinion to church teaching prior to the time of Pius X, but I'd have to do some research to verify that.
Okay, and then he asks, after the publication of Lamentabili Sane, many theologians restated the condemned position as a positive statement. Revelation was completed with the death of the last apostle. But in more recent years, some theologians are stepping back from that positive statement. If public revelation did not end with the death of the last apostle, is there a definite time, event, or condition which closed the era of revelation? Do you want me to continue?
Go ahead, continue.
Okay. Could you walk us through the steps to show how revelation was completed with the death of the last apostle? It is not infallible teaching, if that is the case?
Okay, so... Patrick had a little slip of the tongue in saying that many theologians have restated the condemned proposition as a positive statement. What they've actually done is restated the condemnation as a positive statement. So instead of saying this is wrong,
they
flip it around to say something true, which is revelation was completed with the death of the last apostle. Now, he says that some theologians are stepping back from that positive statement, and I'm not sure who he's thinking about or what alternative position they would be advocating. I can see two different possibilities. If you step away from the positive statement that revelation was completed with the death of the last apostle, then that could mean either that revelation continued, binding public revelation, continued after the death of the last apostle, and I'm not sure who would say that, or it could mean that revelation ended even before the death of the last apostle. And while I would assume that's true, because I assume whoever the last apostle was, he wasn't giving new revelation on his deathbed, and his final spoken sentence was before his death was an item of public revelation. I would assume that all of the revelation had been given some time before the last apostle died. How long before, I don't know. In terms of, is there a definite time or event or condition which closed the era of public revelation? Well, it's the death of the last apostle. It's the passing of the apostolic age, which ends with the death of the last apostle. His final question seems to be, is this an infallible teaching? And on that subject, I would have to say it's not infallible, so far as I know, in terms of a statement by a pope or a magisterial council. I'm unaware of a pope or a magisterial council having issued an infallible teaching on this point. However, that doesn't mean it couldn't be infallible by what's known as the ordinary and universal magisterium of the church, which is the just collective teaching of the bishops in union with the Pope. And if they at any point in time agree that the faithful must definitively hold that something is true, then even though they're not gathered in an ecumenical council, that teaching becomes infallible. And I think there would be at least an argument that the bishops have definitively taught that there are no new revelations following the apostolic age. And the trick is, it can be really hard to document that bishops have taught something definitively without them being in a council. So those are usually arguable, but I think there's at least a case there that you could argue that.
Both Michael and Patrick, thank you for those very interesting questions. There's the music, so we got to take a quick break. It's an internet open forum today. Jimmy Akin is our guest. Lots more great questions from the internet coming up right after this on Catholic Answers Live. When the resurrected Jesus appeared to disciples on the road to Emmaus, they didn't recognize him until the breaking of the bread. The same is true today. In the Holy Eucharist, we really meet Jesus. In The Eucharist is Really Jesus, author Joe Heschmeyer explains how knowing Jesus in the Eucharist is the key to understanding all of Christian faith. Order your copy of The Eucharist is Really Jesus today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore.
Our Lord needs articulate defenders of the truth to spread the joy of the Catholic faith. Catholic Answers Monthly Giving Club, Society 315, helps you fulfill the call in 1 Peter 3:15 to always be prepared to make a defense for the hope that is in you. For as little as $10 a month, you'll help Catholics grow in faith, bring lapsed Catholics home, and lead non-Catholics to the truth. Go to casociety315.com and join today.
Is relativism dead? It sure seems dead. Each day, new moral demands are made and they are presented to us as absolutes. Everything from transgender ideology to physician-assisted suicide is presented as a moral good that all right-thinking people must accept. But Catholic Answers' own Carlo Broussard says look deeper, and you will see today's moralism is just relativism dressed up in new clothes. Carlo's eye-opening book, The New Relativism, shines a light on how the sacred moral teachings of this age cover up a deep denial of moral truth. Order your copy of The New Relativism today at shop.catholic.com and be prepared to defend the truth against aggressive relativism. The New Relativism at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Hi, this is Johnette Williams. We embrace the essence of feminine spirituality on Women of Grace tomorrow at 11 a.m. Eastern here on EWTN Radio. Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. It's an internet open forum. Jimmy Akin is our guest. We've got lots of great questions that have come to us via the internet, via its various modes. If you ever want to submit a question, you can always just send an email to radio@catholic.com. Some of these questions come from other sources, like Jimmy's Facebook conversations with people and all that. But an easy way to do it, if you're like, I want to get in on that internet open forum, just send it to radio@catholic.com. The next question comes from Jason. Jason asks, could the intro to the Gospel of John be discussing the pre-incarnate Christ? I've heard this as an opinion held by some. Note that the verses talk about Jesus coming into his own before, in verses 10 through 13, before announcing he became flesh in verse 14. Is this a plausible interpretation? Did any of the fathers hold it?
I'm not aware of any of the fathers holding it. Now, I should mention that Jason clarified in a separate email to me and I kind of figured this was what he was talking about, but he clarified and mentioned how God sometimes seems to appear in human form in the Old Testament. And these passages are sometimes referred to as involving the second Yahweh or the little Yahweh, because there was some awareness in at this period in Judaism that there was some kind of plurality in the Godhead. They didn't have the full doctrine of the Trinity, and they certainly didn't understand it as clearly as we do, but they did understand that there's Yahweh and he's God, but then there's these other passages in the Old Testament where God seems to show up in mm-hmm. human form, and sometimes he's described as an angel, which just means a messenger. And sometimes you got this messenger there, and then the messenger is sometimes spoken of as if it's a different person than Yahweh, and then sometimes it's spoken of as if it's Yahweh. A famous example of that is at the sacrifice of Isaac. You know, the angel shows up to say, "Whoa, Abraham, don't be so quick." And we're told it's the angel of Yahweh, and then it's spoken of as if it is Yahweh. And so this led to what has since been called the two powers in heaven doctrine, that there's more than one divine being in heaven. Or more than one divine person in heaven, I should say. And you have passages that Jason was thinking of, like where you got the boy Samuel, and he's hearing God's voice as a little boy, and it'll say, "And God came and stood." You know, and there have been people who have, including among the church fathers, who have said these angel of the Lord passages and passages like this, these are the pre-incarnate Christ. So that's a definite opinion that's out there that has traction in Christian history. The question is that the case for the prologue of John's Gospel, which is essentially the first 18 verses of John's Gospel? Well, I think the answer there is no. And I've noted for a long time, even without considering this particular question, that John often writes when he's giving his historical narrative in the course of the Gospel of John, he's very linear. He's very concerned about chronology. But when John is not writing chronological narrative, he gets loopy in the sense of he loops through concepts. He's not proceeding in a linear chronological way. You see that, for example, in his letters, particularly in 1 John, which is a big one. And in 1 John, he's talking through ideas. And if you watch him, he's kind of like Pope John Paul II. He cycles through ideas and they keep coming back, and you proceed in a cyclical way rather than straight through a set of topics without repetition. And so that's just John's style when he's writing something other than history. Well, the prologue of his gospel is not part of the historical narrative. It contains references to history, but it also it's written in a more meditative, cyclical style rather than a strict chronology. And we can see that by reading it. So the first question was, at least the most general question is, does it involve the pre-incarnate Christ? And the answer there is yeah, because the very first verses do. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him, and without him, not anything made that was made. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. So that's all pre-incarnate Christ, but it's not about the pre-incarnate Christ taking on human form prior to the incarnation. The next verse says, "There was a man sent from God whose name was John." Okay, so now we're not at the beginning of the world anymore. We're at John the Baptist. Mm-hmm. Because that's who he's talking about. "He came for testimony, to bear witness to the light, that all might believe through him. He was not the light, but came to bear witness to the light. The true light that enlightens every man was coming into the world." Okay, now he's backed up again, because Jesus came into the world at his birth. And so you can see how we're moving. We're at the beginning of the world, then we're at John the Baptist. Now we're back at Jesus's birth. He was in the world, and the world was made through him. Now we're back at the beginning of creation again. Mm-hmm. Yet the world knew him not. He came to his own, or to his own home, and his own people received him not. Okay, well, that doesn't really describe what happened in these second Yahweh situations in the Old Testament. They did receive him. Samuel received him. Abraham received him. They honored him. So we don't have the Jewish people collectively rejecting the second Yahweh prior to the time of Christ. So that would seem to be talking, verse 11 would seem to be talking about the ministry of Jesus. But to all who received him, he believed in his name. He gave power to become children of God, who were born not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, nor of the will of a man, but of God. And the word became flesh. So now we're back at the incarnation of Christ again. And dwelt among us, full of grace and truth. We have beheld his glory, glory as of the only begotten Son of the Father. So that's the first 14 verses. And you can see we're jumping all over the place in terms of when we're talking about. John has this cyclical, meditative style of writing when he's not doing straight historical narrative. And so I think, you know, if you look at the fact that John the Baptist gets mentioned before he starts discussing the incarnation and before the verses that Jason cited, I think it's clear that that's the frame of reference we're talking about. He's not really talking about stuff that happened in the Old Testament after the creation. He's talking about the creation and kind of general things that apply to everybody, like every man gets this light. But then he's specifically talking about the incarnation of Christ and the appearance of John the Baptist.
Thank you very, very much, Jason, for that question. On we go. This one comes from Jeremy, and it is pithy. Jeremy asks, the book of Jonah, history or parable?
Well, there's some evidence for both, and scholarly opinion is quite divided on this subject. Many scholars, particularly in the last century or so, including quite conservative ones, have concluded that the book of Jonah is sort of a parable. And there are other books that in the Bible, like Tobit and Judith, that are very clearly parables. With Jonah, though, it's not quite so easy. You know, now, one thing we should note, Jonah is not written in the first person. So this is not a book like Isaiah, where the prophet is saying, I did this, and then I did this. It's all third person in Jonah. Jonah did this, then Jonah did that, and then he did this. And so it presents itself as if it's being written by someone other than Jonah. If it was first person narrative, it would be less likely to be a parable. But since it is third-person narrative, there's more of a possibility of it being a parable. People will also point to the big fish that swallows Jonah as evidence that this is a parable. But I don't find that really persuasive, because there are cases where people have been swallowed by whales and lived to tell the tale. Call me Ishmael. although actually the big whale in that... it doesn't end well for Captain Ahab, I'll put it that way.
You're giving it away. Oh, man. And that book just came out in the 1800s, and you're giving it away.
In general terms only.
All right.
I don't mention what Ahab does with his arm at the end, for example. So I don't think that's decisive. And then we have the fact that we have independent attestation to the existence of Jonah. If you look in 2 Kings 14:25, which is a historical book, it mentions the historical existence of the prophet Jonah, who's the son of this particular guy, and it's the same name. So we have independent attestation that Jonah was a real individual. Now, there are clear theological lessons that are being taught in Jonah through the prophet's experiences. So I think it's fair to say that it is a clearly didactic book. You know, it's meant to teach you lessons by example. But I think it's also ancient, so it's not history in the modern sense. But I don't think we can safely say that it's simply a parable. I think you can safely say that about Tobit and Judith, And I respect people who would say it about Jonah, but I think that we can't say it confidently. So I think there's evidence for this. You can argue it's a parable. You can also argue it's history. You could argue it's something in the middle, that it's a didactic narrative that is based on historical events, but that we might not want to take every element of it literally. So I would kind of put it, failing decisive proof one way or another, I would tend to say, well, it could be either, and it could be this middle thing, you know, a story that is based on historical events, but also contains notable didactic elements or teaching elements that are, that may mean not everything in it is to be taken strictly literally.
Jeremy, thank you very much for that question. That brings us to the break. We'll take a quick break. Be right back with more Internet Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. We'll be right back with more Catholic Answers Live.
The Catechism defines evangelization as the proclamation of Christ and his gospel by word and the testimony of life. But what does that look like in real life? It looks like St. Paul street evangelists out in the public square sharing the good news. We're a Catholic nonprofit that starts conversations by handing out free sacramentals. Then we employ our method of listen, befriend, proclaim, and invite. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
Carry the faith wherever you go. Catch up with the latest news from Washington, D.C., the Vatican, and the world on all of our EWTN news platforms, including EWTN News Nightly, the National Catholic Register, and the world over. Download the EWTN app at EWTNapps.com today.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Hey, more than 400,000 copies are in print of Trent Horn's book, Why We're Catholic. And it's got 1,600 five-star reviews over at Amazon. And it's on sale right now over at shop.catholic.com. So you can get it an individual copy. You can get it in bulk. Check it out right now, today, at shop.catholic.com. Jimmy Akin, our guest, and it's an internet open forum. And let's see, where are we? We got, I think Bo is next. Bo asks this. When Jesus performed various miracles in the Gospels, why did he tell the recipients not to tell anyone what he had done? Why did he want his miraculous deeds to be kept secret?
Well, the first thing to say is Jesus did this on some occasions, but he didn't do it on all occasions. And one of the things that you discover if you do a careful study of this is when he told people to keep quiet about it, he was in Jewish territory. But when he was in Gentile territory, he would do the opposite. So, for example, when he goes in across the Sea of Galilee into Gentile territory and he encounters the Gadarene demoniac, okay, this guy's a Gadarene. He's not a Jew. And so Jesus is in Gentile territory, which is why they're keeping the pigs there, because they're not Gentiles. They're not Jews. They're not under the pork restriction. And so When he exercises the Gadarene demoniac, he tells him, go and tell people what God has done for you. And it's only in when he's in Jewish territory that he says to keep it on the down low. So why would that be? What would explain that difference? Well, it would presumably have to do with the different reactions that Jews and Gentiles will have to Jesus doing divine miracles. What are Gentiles going to do? Well, Gentiles, some of them may worship the God of the Jews, but not exclusively, usually. And so in if you're told to go tell people about it, you're being told to go tell what the God of the Jews, the true God, did for you. So this is going to be a form of evangelization. And that's how it'll be taken in Gentile territory. But now let's suppose Jesus did the same thing in Jewish territory, where every time he healed someone, he said, go tell everybody about this. He would be mobbed. In fact, we read about him being mobbed, for example, in Capernaum, where after he exorcises another demoniac in the synagogue in Capernaum, which I've actually been to. You can go to this synagogue today, the ruins of it, but it's pretty impressive. And then he goes over to Peter's house, and you can also go to Peter's house in Capernaum. I've been there too. And it says that, and he heals Peter's mother-in-law. And then it talks about how they started, people started bringing all kinds of sick people and demoniacs and the paralyzed guy. They started bringing all these people to Jesus. And it mentions they couldn't even eat a meal because they were being mobbed. And Jesus didn't want to be mobbed all the time. It would prevent him from being able to travel around and conduct his itinerant ministry. And he even tells the disciples in various places, let's get out of here. Let's go be alone for a while. And the people still follow him. And that's without him encouraging this behavior. So if he had told everybody, go publicize what I've just done for you, it would have just made the problem all the more worse, because Jewish people are going to have a very different reaction. They're going to mob him and impede his ministry. And they're going to try to do something else. They're going to try to make him king, because they perceive him as this miracle-working Messiah who's going to kick out the Romans and be our new king. And in fact, John's gospel talks about how at one point, you know, Jesus was confronted with this crowd and he had to leave because he realized that they were going to compel him to be king if he didn't. And he didn't want to be a political king. That's not his mission. My kingdom is not of this world. So in order to keep from being mobbed and to keep people from trying to force him into a political role as Messiah, he told a lot of the people he helped. He wanted to help them, and he did help them, but he wanted them to keep it on the down low in Jewish circles because of what his role as Messiah would mean for them. But when he was outside of Jewish circles in Gentile territory, he wanted to promote knowledge and belief in the true God, the God of the Jews. And so he would tell them, go announce this. Tell people what God has done for you.
That's a fascinating distinction. And I don't know that I've ever heard anyone make it so clearly before. Bo, I'm very grateful for that question. Thank you very, very much. We continue with Internet Open Forum. This question comes from Bobby. Could God create a rock too heavy for him to lift?
No. This question comes up a lot, and it has been recognized for centuries that the answer to this is no. For example, Thomas Aquinas explains that God can do he's omnipotent, he can do anything as long as it doesn't involve a logical contradiction. A logical contradiction is where the terms themselves conflict, so that they don't have any actual meaning. They may sound like they do, but if you think about it, they don't. Like if I say a four-sided triangle, okay, that's not a real shape. Triangles, by definition, have three angles and three sides. If they don't, it's not a triangle. Therefore, four-sided triangle is a meaningless string of words. It doesn't correspond to any possible entity. So God can't make four-sided triangles. Well, what about a stone too heavy for him to lift? Well, if he's got omnipotence, then he has infinite lifting power. And a stone that couldn't be lifted by a being with infinite lifting power would have to have more than infinite mass. And that is another logical contradiction. You can't have something that's more than infinite. You might have different levels of infinity, but it would have to be, but God's got all of them in terms of lifting power. So it'd have to be beyond any concept of infinity. And there is nothing beyond the concept of infinity. That's another meaningless concept. So the idea of a stone too heavy for an omnipotent being to lift is logical nonsense. It's not a real entity, not a possible entity, and therefore, like a four-sided triangle, it's something God can't make. Incidentally, got a funny little personal story. Back when I was in grad school in philosophy, this question came up.
Yeah.
And I was being a little facetious, and I said, no, God could not create a rock too heavy for him to lift, because any object that massive would collapse under its own weight and become a black hole. And my professor in that class who, and thus ceased to be a rock. And my professor in that class, who I just recently got together for lunch with, said, "Congratulations, you've just dodged the, you've just answered the question while dodging the issue. Welcome to academia."
What a great response. But then you moved out into popular apologetics, because probably because you didn't want to avoid the issue. Bobby, yeah. Thanks.
I was being facetious even then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Bobby, thank you very, very much for the question. Rex wants to ask this, another question about a rock. When the stone was rolled back from the tomb, what became of the cord and seal?
Okay, so there's no mention of a cord in the Gospels. You may have encountered some presentations of this story that involved a cord, but there's not one mentioned in the Gospels. So I would say we don't have evidence that there was a cord, therefore nothing happened to it. What we actually read, now there is in some translations, there is a verse that could suggest a seal was used. For example, if you read Matthew 27:66, in some translations it will say, "So they went and made the tomb secure by sealing the stone and setting a guard." Okay, so that could sound like they sealed the stone. They must have put a seal on it. Yeah, not necessarily. The word that's used in Greek for sealing the stone here is sphragizo. And sphragizo can mean to provide with a seal. So it can mean you put a seal on something, but it also means to close tightly. So it has two different meanings. You could interpret Matthew 27:66 as meaning that they rolled the stone in front of it, they put a seal on the stone, mm-hmm. and then they established set a guard over it. Or it could just mean they made the tomb secure by closing the stone tightly and setting a guard. And we have a parallel expression in English. We'll talk about sealing an envelope, you know, and we don't literally mean put a seal on the envelope.
Right, right.
That's where the expression came from. But today, seal an envelope just means close it securely. And that's what happened with the verb sphragizo in Greek. It came to just mean, even though it originally meant to provide with a seal, it came to mean to just close securely or close tightly. So I don't think we have good evidence that there was a seal. And so I think they just rolled the stone into place. There's no other mention of a literal seal in any of the other Gospels. The women, for example, when they come, they're not saying to themselves, "Ooh, who's going to take off the seal?" They just say, "Who's going to roll the stone away?" And so it sounds to me like the stone was just rolled into place and secured in that way, but not that there was literally a seal put on it. So I would say I don't think we have evidence, good evidence, for either a cord or a seal in the case of the tomb. And so I don't think anything happened to them. I think they just rolled back the stone. I think the angels just rolled back the stone.
Ah, gotcha. Yeah, right. Yeah, that sealing the envelope thing is a good, that makes it clear how that could be. So when they put Jesus in the tomb, just out of curiosity, Jimmy, was that meant to be his permanent resting place? I mean, I know that he rose from the dead, but I mean, the intention of the people, was that meant to be his permanent resting place?
Well, possibly.
Okay.
So it's because of the way Jewish burial practices worked. What they would do is they would put your dead body in a tomb on kind of a ledge, and it would deteriorate, you know, because to dust you shall return. And so after a year or so, they'd come back, and all your flesh would have rotted away, but your bones would be there. And they'd take your bones and clean the bones.
Okay.
And then put them in a box known as an ossuary or bone box. And if you were a member of the family, they'd just put you back the bone box in the same family tomb. But in this case, since Jesus was a member of a different family and this was an emergency burial, they might have been envisioning giving the bone box or the bones back to his original family.
Yeah, gotcha. Jimmy Akin is our guest. It's an open forum, but it's an internet open forum. And we got all kinds of wonderful questions still to come in the second hour. Jimmy will be back with us and we will continue with Internet Open Forum right after this on Catholic Answers Live.